Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
We are honored to have a morning with Brad Hintz, I think, who's stayed with us through TV and staying with us through radio as well. Brad Hintz, the former Lehman CFO and NYU professor, joins us now. Good morning to you, Brad.
Good morning.
Let's look back 10 years. Solvency crisis or liquidity crisis? What did that bank actually face?
Liquidity, no question about it. You lost repo, which you lost commercial paper. Your clients were selling back long-term debt. Your counterparties were asking for more collateral. Typically, financial institutions don't die for lack of equity. They die because of a funding run.
What is the response 10 years on look like? Because what strikes me as amazing 10 years on is there are still huge debate about whether the response was the right response from regulators, from government officials to allow this bank to fail.
It was a mistake to let it fail. You scared the market. And in scaring the market, it was that uncertainty which led to the next thing, right? Which was everybody pulls in their lending. Everyone pulls in their counterparty risk. And well, you have a global credit reduction.
Did it fail because there wasn't a Jamie Dimon there to write the check because he was preoccupied with a previous failure, Bear Stearns? Was it just simply there wasn't somebody else equivalent?
In other words, there wasn't a marriage partner.
Yeah, there was, or a divorce partner, whatever you want to call it. But I don't know where I got that. But Brad, Mr. Dimon was exhausted from bailing out Bear Stearns, and there was no obvious candidate to take out Lehman. Is that right?
Well, you had Barclays at one point, right? You had and certainly you had Bank of America as another name. We've all read the history on this.
Yeah.
That there were a number of things going on. I think the issue you have is a management team at Lehman that was looking at this versus the history of other liquidity events, right? As a result, their balance sheet continued to rise through 2008, right?
You said earlier this was an opportunity for Mr. Fuld. That's how they looked at it.
Well, in terms of liquidity events are an opportunity in fixed income. In essence, you're buying good assets at a troubled price. If you have enough funding to make it through the crisis, you're fine. Lehman had 12 months in their liquidity plan. And who would have guessed that a liquidity event in mortgage backs would swing across the entire credit market, ultimately into the government market? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was the issue. I think we have an example. I mean, there's an example of Salomon Brothers facing a liquidity event in the 1990s, and their CFO raised their internal cost of funding, put their balance sheet into a nosedive, shed assets. And that bought them time, and they made it through that liquidity crisis. Had Lehman done the same thing? I mean, think of what Goldman did. Goldman, not only did they made a bet against it, but they also did not grow their balance sheet. Goldman pulled in their horns. Lehman did not.
Yeah.
Huge distinction. And that was that really set the stage. As the markets became ever illiquid, Lehman was stuck with a concrete side of its balance sheet. Its asset side froze, its liability side ran off. And, you know, the end of Lehman occurred. The surprise was the Fed, right? Because the Fed had taken action with Bear, and the Fed had taken action by allowing the broker dealers to have access to the discount window.
Yeah.
The assumption among observers was the Fed was going to make sure that this was orderly. And the Lehman balance failure was not orderly, and there was the problem.
So let's pick up on that. And a final question. You use the word panic. Officials now believe they have the structures, the regulations to allow for an orderly failure of a bank. When it actually comes to it, if we ever have to face a crisis like this again, whether it's in 10 years, 20, 30 years, wherever it is, do you actually see the government and officials applying the rules that they currently have to allow for an orderly failure of a bank ever again in the United States?
The Fed needs to be able to lend wherever there is a need. They're tied up too much at this point. In essence, we've established a set of rules that will be just perfect in the last crisis, and we don't know what the next crisis will be.
I mean, with this, it goes back to Badgett. Folks, for those of you not keeping score, Badgett was a London banker and journalist who decided we have to be the lender of the last resort. If Mr. Paulson was sitting here, or Mr. Geithner, they would state to you that they had a lender of last resort responsibility to bail out the system. Obviously, they did that with an expanded balance sheet in all that. In 2020 hindsight, how do we get forward? As we look back, all with the luxury of 2020 hindsight, what's the key lesson 10 years from now?
What is the key lesson?
What did we learn from 10 years ago? It's going to be the key lesson when this happens 10 years forward.
You need a strong team like we had. The three gentlemen who ran the crisis stepped up and put their own careers on the line. Had they stuck their head in the sand, we would have faced a depression. They didn't. They moved very, very quickly. We can argue about whether Lehman was a mistake or an underestimation, but they clearly moved, and you can see it from the U.S. economy. U.S. economy has come back better than others.
Brett Hintz, thank you so much. Honored to have you with us with New York University. John, I'll give you one anecdote for me. I got the TARP plan, I think it was, and I literally sat at a wonderful Greek restaurant with a beverage of my choice and read every word of it. It was, I think, 40 pages. 2 days later, it was over 104 pages.
Yeah. And I'm sure it wasn't just the beverage.
That's how fast.
Yeah,
it wasn't the beverage. And that's how fast this expanded. They were moving literally on a 9 and 12 hour timeline of adjusting documents and paperwork.
Brad, it's been great to get your thoughts this morning. And thank you very much for giving so much of your time to Bloomberg Surveillance, both on TV.
Brad Hintz, thank you.
And on radio.
Gyration in the Turkish lira, weaker lira this morning on Erdogan headlines, and then a massive move down to 6.13, stronger lira off historic high rates by the Turkish Central Bank. Usef Kemal Adin is in Istanbul right now. Usef, who is Murat Çetinkaya, the governor of the Turkish Central Bank, and what is his position today? Where does he stand within Turkish politics, economics, and finance?
Tom, this was always going to be a critical test of credibility for the governor, who remains largely untested in the new Erdogan spheres of influence and power. And so what happened in the last few minutes was the central bank was able to reassert a level of confidence among foreign investors. He was able to push back in terms of what the central bank thinks needs to be done versus what Mr. Erdogan believes in terms of unorthodox economic theories. And what the central bank said is that there are risks to the inflation outlook. There is an issue with demand. They said tight policy will remain until there's an improvement in inflation. And remember, we're at 15-year highs, right? So the weak currency is fed into prices here.
Right.
It's been reflected in the data, and now the central bank has to act.
Usef, thank you so much from Istanbul this morning.
Joining us from Washington, I'm pleased to say, is a former central bank official. Used to work on Threadneedle Street at the Bank of England. His name, Adam Posen, Peterson Institute for International Economics President. And he joins us now. Good morning to you, Adam. Your thoughts on a monster rate hike at the central bank in Turkey?
Thank you for having me. They didn't really have a choice, but I'm glad they had the guts to do it. They're caught in the proverbial between a rock and a hard place. They have to be very active to offset the pressures from President Erdogan, which of course erodes the credibility of everything in Turkey's economic sphere. So the central bank has to try to provide that credibility. But as we know, and we saw recently with Argentina and other places, if the central bank just keeps hiking rates at a huge amount, it's not enough to fix the underlying problem. It can't fix an underlying problem.
Adam, have you ever seen anything like this? Moments before a central bank decision for the president of the nation to come out and call on the central bank to cut rates.
Well, not in recent recollection, I mean, but in a sense, actually, it is the one heartening thing here is that says that the Central Bank of the Republic of Turkey's independence actually is a little stronger than some people thought, because the President Erdogan was able to do this and they'd still be defied. I think that's a huge signal. I mean, so many institutions and government and civil society have been thrown away by Erdogan's regime, and they've jailed, tens of thousands of people. That the central bank was still able to do this, I think, is the most hopeful thing we've seen about Turkey for some time.
John Farrow, keep going here. I'm still setting up my terminal. But, John, up 3%, down 8%. It is now bordering on a 12% round-trip move in lira.
It is amazing.
1-2.
Can we call that volatile?
I can call it somebody really won in the hedge fund space and many lost.
Yeah, I'm squeezing some shorts out there with a 625 basis point rate hike at the Central Bank of Turkey. What's interesting about this, Adam, as you know better than most, you have to compare this to where inflation is.
Right.
Inflation is close to 18% in Turkey. So even with rates where they were previously at 17.75%, they didn't even have a real interest rate over in Turkey. Does positive 600 basis points real help out the situation? Is that enough?
Well, it depends in part on Erdogan and the other factors going on. I think it does matter a lot and help a lot, both for the currency credibility and for getting the monetary offset to a lot of crazy things that are going on. But they have structural problems about currency mismatch in private sector loans. They have real doubts about fiscal policy going forward because of Erdogan's influence. They have political concerns. When I say they, I mean the Turkish people are beset by these things. So, again, the central bank can only do so much. They're doing the right thing. We had talked about on the Bloomberg Surveillance TV program the fact that they may have capital controls in the offing, or that they already have put in this announcement about having to recontract in lira. Again, that is something that the IMF and others now recognize can be useful temporarily, but they have to use that to do something else. This is all good short term, but isn't going to fix the long term.
Well, let's talk about the economic fundamentals at the moment, Adam. What does an interest rate of 24% mean to the Turkish economy right now? Is that a strangle on the Turkish economy? Can it work through this problem in the same way Argentina can work through the problem? How big is this?
I mean, as you pointed out, the real interest rate, of course, we're now talking about a 600 basis point real interest rate, which is hard but not horrific. It is a very big shift. Turkey went into this economically with somewhat better fundamentals than Argentina. So again, if the underlying large political forces at work were contained, you could think about getting through this. But keeping interest rates that high is not going to work. It's just good as an alternative to having a full capital flight.
Okay, I get that. It's in Obstfeld and Rogoff, and most of us read it. I mean, you helped write it. But Adam, what I find interesting to the domestic economy is how does business get done with a one-week repo of 2-4%?
Oh, no, it doesn't get
done. It doesn't get done.
No. Sorry, Tom. I didn't mean to bury the point.
Oh, no, you didn't. Farrow, it's John's fault, not yours.
No. It's mine. It's mine. John's perfect. But it's business doesn't get done. The question is, is business being temporarily interrupted or having full-on capital flight and a sudden stop in the economy? It's still better to have an interest rate-driven, domestically controlled stop that has some chance of being pulled out than to have a capital flight driven sudden stop. And that's what we're comparing to. It's not versus the baseline, things would be fine if they hadn't put up interest rates.
This is Turkey, Adam. And the question that we've asked throughout the last couple of months is whether what we're seeing in EM is more than just local issues, idiosyncratic problems. Do you see a broader issue for the whole complex right now?
I've been more reluctant than some people to say that because I've seen now a few cycles where the Fed tightens and in this case the U.S. runs an irresponsible fiscal policy and money leaves EM, but usually it's the worst ones get hit first. And so one could have well argued, as we at Peterson did 6-12 months ago, that Turkey and Argentina were the obvious targets. All that qualification said, I think this is where the trade war aspect between U.S. and China and the NAFTA going backwards and affecting global auto production starts to hit. This is where you may get spillovers onto places right. like Indonesia and Brazil, and it becomes a broader EM problem.
Adam, looking ahead to the European Central Bank meeting a little bit later, I imagine it's good news to President Draghi that Turkey's getting its act together.
Yeah, but I don't think it's central for the ECB decision making. I think it's very important for Europe. But for the ECB, they don't have the tools or the political mandate to do much about Turkey. So I think they're just going to focus on European outlook.
Set a forecast later from the ECB, set to downgrade the growth forecast. Inflation forecasts remain the same. Have they got the data behind them to remove policy accommodation here, Adam?
Borderline. It wouldn't be a mistake if they did remove a little, but I think they don't need to do anything terribly strong. There is, as always in the euro area, an issue of the unbalanced growth, and removing policy accommodation would probably disproportionately hit Italy at the moment. Now, that might be intentional as a warning shot to the Italian populist government to continue to toe the line on fiscal policy. So they might want to do that. But, you know, this isn't outrageous inflation or enormous growth in ECB land that they have to raise a lot.
Within all your perspective, Adam, and the incredible staff you've got at Peterson Institute, is this like a predictable EM crisis? Is that overwrought? Can it be escaped? Or is it just simply, look, the dominant party, the U.S., the Fed raises rates, and this is a path of tensions that you get? Is that the observation?
I think my team at Peterson, Tom, which is always grateful for your shout-outs, has a mixed view, as we do on most things. But basically, our view is it doesn't have to be terrible. You don't have to have the word crisis except for countries like Turkey and Argentina. And there is issues that are being revealed, but absent some kind of panic, it really was those two countries, maybe South Africa, maybe a couple others, that were in trouble, but not the whole EM complex. I mean, think about the taper tantrum of a few years ago, where it was Brazil and a couple other particularly vulnerable economies got hit, but not everybody. Everybody got a bit of a slowing. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion we have a crisis.
Adam, we might have a crisis in the future if there's a downturn and they still don't have a positive interest rate at the ECB. How much longer do they need this cycle to continue for them to have an appropriate interest rate to deal with the next downturn?
The longer the better. But realistically, this is the ultimate dilemma, right? You don't put the economy through a recession to make sure that you have ammo for the next recession, right? That doesn't make any sense. So you just have to play it as it comes. I think the thing to be said is both politically and economically, the ECB can restart unconventional monetary policy through the banking system much more easily than the Fed if needed.
Dr. Posen, we have to let you go. We have a presidential tweet. So we'll let Adam Posen go. He is with the Peterson Institute. We thank him. Megan Green of Manulife, who's been patient to be with us today, not on the dryness of ECB, but as he mentioned there delicately, the effects of a trade war. And there it is, tit for tat, tit for that, tit for tat. ECB brings their growth projections in. Is Chairman Powell going to bring his growth projections in?
Yeah, so Mario Draghi weighed much more into trade than the Fed actually has. I was surprised by that because it's not really their lane, though it does affect growth and inflation forecasts. And I think the Fed talks about trade nonstop, if not in their official speeches on the sidelines at conferences. So I think that trade is already being factored into the Fed's growth and inflation forecast.
But will they adjust again? I mean, what's so important here, Megan, and you're wonderful at this, is the gradient moving from 4%, whatever, and everybody agrees, well, it's too good to be true, we go down. But along that gradient path, can they maintain control of the message in conversation? Not that we'll see a jump condition like Lira today, but or do we have instabilities ahead? Is the Fed manages the message?
Yeah, so I think that the Fed, we all agree that QT is the best it's going to get. It's going to decelerate from there. We're going to basically converge with our potential GDP growth as fiscal right. stimulus starts to peter out towards the end of next year. So I do think that the Fed will manage to manage that message. But I also think that, you know, the withdrawal of global liquidity from the system is partly what's causing all this volatility in E&M. And that's being driven by the Fed. So as we have developments with that, actually, you could get some volatility in the Fed having to react.
In the time that we've got left, and we need much more, we have to get you back. You know, what's so great here, folks, is Megan Green came in the day of 100 wins for the Red Sox, first time since 1940. Which, and I've been talking about Enos Slaughter all day, which was before your time, Megan. Before my time too. But within that, Megan, is this new phrase, dollarization. And I used in my opening script today, liraization, which is what Erdogan wants in Turkey. What's different now is there's a lot of dollar debt abroad, isn't there?
Yeah, so if you look at debt being issued in EM denominated in different currencies, euro-denominated debt's flattened out, yen-denominated debt has actually fallen since the financial crisis, U.S. dollar-denominated debt has absolutely exploded since the financial crisis. Because rates have been so low, it's been so cheap, it made perfect sense for these countries to be issuing debt in U.S. dollars. But now that the dollar's gotten stronger, and I think that has been driven in large part by moves in the renminbi, and so that will continue as we continue to poke China in the eye on trade, I think the squeeze will just get tighter for the emerging market countries.
And what is brilliantly said, and what's so important about this relationship is the Fed wants to shift and normalize rates. And they've got these set of things saying, not so fast. I mean, they've got to confront that at some point.
Yeah, that's right. And when you speak to the Fed, actually, nobody's really looking at EM or at the global system that
much. Or the dollarization of the system.
That's right. And Lael Brainard's the one person who's focused on this, but no one else has picked it up. Rich Clarida actually might pick it up, given his professional history. So we might hear more about that out of the Fed. But for the most part, the Fed is really just looking at the U.S. indicators domestically.
Okay.
And is justifying its continued gradual path.
Are you going to come back when the Red Sox win 110 games in one season?
Happily.
Please. Megan Green with us with Manulife and, of course, an affiliation there with the John Hancock Company of 106.1 FM Boston. Why don't you get us to a wonderful guest?
Well, Mark Lehman knows all about this.
To talk to us about Apple.
He knows everything about Apple. He joins us here in studio of JMP Securities. He's the president. Mark, it's a pleasure. Let me see. Are you wearing your watch, your Apple Watch? No.
The iWatch is at
home. Oh, my God. Your Apple Watch is home.
It's a weekend watch for me.
It's a weekend watch.
Yes.
Okay. Do you believe that it's going to end up being an everyday watch?
I think already it has for a lot of people. I think the ubiquity will probably continue given some of the health announcements as of yesterday. But it continues a theme of Apple, which is it pervades our life. And I'll give you a perfect example of that for myself. My daughter, Kate, moved here 6 weeks ago to start her job, her first job after college. And I noticed... as I said to her at dinner last night,
congratulations, by the way.
Thank you for that. And I said to my her last night, I said, you haven't taken any cash out of your bank account since you moved here. She's getting paid and she's paying rent and all that. But she hasn't gone to the ATM and physically taken a dollar out. And she looked at me like I had four eyes and said, Dad, I use Apple Pay. And it's just telling to me how much the ecosystem of Apple, besides the wonderful products, and we all saw the announcements as of yesterday, how much that's invaded our lives and how much it will continue to.
I want to just put the technology on hold for just a second and get your thoughts about the retail operation that Apple runs. Do you think that an investor in Apple is rewarded for the quality and the vibrancy of their retail business?
That's a great question. I think over time they have been. Clearly the stock has done really well this year, and obviously over time it's been magical as a shareholder since 2002 when they launched, really in the summer of 2002, their first real groundbreaking product. But I think it will continue to, because that supply chain, that ecosystem that they have will continue to garner more attention. And I think as they put more and more products in consumers' hands, and obviously it will be media continuing and what they're doing with the health aspects, and we're going to get into autonomous and other areas, the home. Clearly, they're invading the home, and there's that race to the home to own the house, whether it's in security or entertainment or wellness. And I think they're going to continue to garner a better multiple.
The fact is, I believe trees grow to the sky. I believe that's a phrase from, I'm going to give credit to Mr. Weinberg ages ago at Goldman Sachs. They come out with a September roadshow. Come on, you could have written the headline 6 hours before they did it. There's going to be an iPhone X, iPhone XS, iPhone 11, iPhone 14. What do they do when the innovation ends? That's an ageless Tom Watson question. What do they do when the September game's over?
I mean, that's really the $64,000 question. And analysts, for as far as I can tell, maybe as much as a decade since they started, have been calling the end of that innovation, and I've yet to see it. I think if you worry about that now, you start to trim your position. I don't worry about that right now, because there's so many places where I think we are, our lives are going to be touched for the better. And given the kind of ecosystem they have, and given the billion embedded devices, they're going to be the one you want to watch.
With your magic and history in San Francisco, I hate to say this, folks, but out west, they actually look west across the Pacific. Unlike on the East Coast, psychologically, there's a huge, huge difference. And Mark, you go with their Samsung in Korea, or the other names you know better than me. How do they compete with the sage nature, the wisdom that we see out of Cupertino? How do they compete with it over time?
Well, it's a great question, and I think they will. There's no lack of competition, right? There's no lack of people who, and of course, if you look at the number of units, the Apple ecosystem,
but the profits,
right? And because of the aspirational nature of the product globally, and because of the embedded billion units that they have out there already, it's very hard to change your phone. It's very hard to, it's like changing a bank. You don't want to do it. And because that ecosystem is so powerful, and because they continue to innovate, I mean, just that small announcement about the fall detection on the watch yesterday, it's going to change what it looks like for somebody over the age of 60 to want to.
See how he looks at me when he says that?
I mentioned this earlier to you.
Michael Barr, help me here. Pharaoh's all over me today because I can do like my EKG or something off my new
ECG. You know, I keep telling him.
Well, it all depends on what you think about the Tigers and Lions.
You had a heart attack the other day. I mean, come on. Wait a minute.
Mark. Can you please disabuse Mr. Keene of the notion that people don't use those earbuds, the ear pods?
I mean, I think they do. And I am no savvy technologist, but they do. And I think.
And they work.
And they work great. And I have one
in
my hand right now.
You're pulling them out of your pocket right now.
And I think they do look goofy, right? You do walk down the street with these, but I will tell you the quality and the ability, and also just the other products are just not that good. And it's just a perfect example. They're expensive for what they are compared to others. You can buy them for half the price for somebody else. They just don't work as well as these do. And I think that's a perfect example of their watch. The watch.
And if you have a problem, you bring it back to the store.
Exactly. And you go back to the stores. Their customer service and their ability to get things done and have people who you walk in who do the right by you is just unique.
Never enough time. Mark Lehman, thank you so much. With JMP Securities, with decades of wisdom on San Francisco and truly the innovation of the West Coast.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.